Okay, well, this morning I'll be describing a mapping project on a relatively small coastal rainforest watershed on the west coast of British Columbia. And each of the images on this title slide provide a window into particular aspects of interest in this project. On the right, that beautiful coastal bay shows part of the Quakshua Channel, which is the focus of the research program for which this work was undertaken. That program aims to understand the movement of terrestrial materials, most importantly carbon, from the land to the marine ecosystems of this small channel on the coast. And the other aspect of that rightmost slide is the boat, which is the main form of access on these remote watersheds. This area hasn't been extensively logged, not because we wouldn't have liked to log it, but it turns out the area isn't really all that productive in a sense that there are large quantities of timber that would be suitable for harvesting. So because there hasn't been a lot of logging, there's very few roads, and so the boat has a role in our story as we proceed here. The middle picture of the old-growth cedar forest on sloping ground is maybe your typical image of what these ecosystems look like. And it's a warm landscape, mean annual temperature near 9 degrees, almost, 2,800 millimeters of precipitation each year, lots of rainfall. And if you had that vision of the coastal rainforest, you would be correct in part. But perhaps on the left is in some ways an equally common, if not more common, vista in the study area, where a mosaic of bedrock outcrops, shallow blanket bogs, and bog woodlands occupy the level to gently sloping, even moderately sloping ground in this area. And this was a revelation for me, because I'm actually done most of my work in the interior of British Columbia, and this landscape in some ways was, in the interior where water, of course, is precious, and more water always means the bigger trees. In this landscape, things are somewhat upside down, where the excessive water restricts productivity on these flatter areas. So with these images as a prelude, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Paul Sanborn, assistant professor at University of Northern British Columbia. I've worked with Paul for years. He's the leader of the soil program in this watershed effort, and soil scientist, and he was present virtually on every plot that was studied in this project. Ian Giesbrecht works for the Quakshua Watershed Program, which is part of the Hakai Institute. It's a privately funded research institute, quite an interesting model of research. A fellow named Eric Peterson that grew up on the coast and spent his early career actually working in the resource industry on the coast, went on to become a very successful tech entrepreneur, and returned to invest upwards of $160 million in a research program on an abandoned fishing camp in the northern part of Calvert Island. So he's done just a tremendous amount of different types of research, and I was delighted when the phone rang and it was Paul asking me if I wanted to spend a couple of weeks out there doing soil survey and to address the questions that they had in this watershed program. Kyra Hoffman is a PhD candidate, and she was part of the early ecological surveys that occurred in this landscape, and she contributed many plots to our effort. So the study site is about 500 kilometers north of Vancouver, and the talk today will include the following sections. I'll give a little bit more information about the watershed program and the study area, and then go into a description of the field methods and the modeling efforts, and then show you some results. So this is what the area looks like. The channel is that narrow body of water. It's about 10 kilometers long between these two islands. It's part of the Heckett Lowland Physiographic Region in British Columbia, 7,000 hectares. Elevations range up to about 1,000 meters, mean annual temperature and precip I talked about. Western hemlock is the climax vegetation here, and the The parent material is derived from this granodiorite bedrock of Cretaceous age, and it's pretty uniform. There's not really much else in terms of bedrock there. But there, it's a very complex landscape. The topography shows a steep relief, and there are only patchy deposits of glacial materials here. The soils are thin. There's various sort of reasons people think why there aren't a lot of deposits. I mean, there's not a lot of contributing area. And some sense is that many of the glacial materials are at the bottom of the ocean that were shed off the island shortly after deglaciation. So then in our current climate, acidic, strongly leached soils have developed, and there are pronounced surface accumulations of organic matter. So why did the interest in soil mapping arise in this project? Well, the streams flowing from these watersheds carry very high levels of dissolved organic matter. Sometimes many parts of the year they run the color of black tea. And there was interest from the food web perspective in the marine channel, but also there's sort of this dissolved organic carbon moving out of these watersheds, this kind of a process-based study. And it was thought, not unreasonably, I think, that the distribution of materials and processes from the soil perspective in these watersheds may have a significant influence on the timing and quantity of these carbon fluxes. So then our challenge was to construct a digital soil map for the area to improve the understanding of the hydrological processes and to identify and characterize the major soil types and processes in this landscape. So there was no soil survey here before we started. There was a few ecological plots, and many times they include soils data, but not in any extensive way. So field methods here. So this was the plan, conditioned Latin hypercube sampling design, which is basically it's kind of a random sampling approach, but it conditions, if you like, or it adjusts the random sampling, not just in geographic space, but also in attribute space. So to carry the range of elevations, the range of slopes, all these kinds of factors, drainage. And it does distribute the plots across the landscape, but it's apparently been considered to be the most efficient way to sample for digital soils mapping. However, we quickly realized back to the boat that there was a very difficult way to get to most of those plots. Sanborn called me up. He was out there for the first week, and he called me up on day two, and he said, "It's not going to work, Chuck. We're just not going to get to most of these plots." And so what you can see, if I just click back towards those slides a little bit, it's not perfect, but we end up with these clusters of points because we wanted to retain still a random element to the sample location, but we basically ended up running transects between those points that we could get to. You'll see that most of the points are clustered along the coast, but we did have helicopter access for a few days, and those are the places that are high in the landscape. Each of those little clusters is about what a person can walk in a day and dig. So we get six or eight pits a day and walk more than a couple of kilometers in this landscape. And I was tired, but the young field assistants were also tired, so it wasn't just age that slowed us down. We added an additional 117 points the year after, and then there was a series of these, like I said, these existing ecosystem plots. So we came up with about 375 points for the raw material, and after the initial phase of modeling, Ian, the ecologist, noted that our model was not predicting bedrock as well as he would like. This becomes kind of an interesting part of the story. So we added 40 points. I thought 10% would be an appropriate number. I know that we used random forest, and the thinking is that sometimes if you overload, random forest can be sensitive to the number of points you add in various categories. And so we tried 10%, and I'll show you just a little bit about what the impact of that was when we tried to fix, let's say, the model in these bedrock areas. This is what it looked like approximately, the workflow, random forest classification for soil map type. We did a terrain and a site series map as well, ecological map. I won't go into those in great detail. And then one of the key things we thought would be to describe the depth of the organic and mineral materials. It seemed pretty simple at the time when we started that would be one thing we could achieve, and I think we did, but even that wasn't as simple as we thought. We used 23 predictors. One of the things that really attracted me to this project was they had a 1 meter LIDAR elevation model for the whole island. We ended up scaling it up to a 5 meter elevation model because our plot size was 10 meters, so we thought that would be a reasonable sort of compromise, and it would seem to be a little easier. We derived 15 topographic variables from that DEM, and then we also had veg metrics from the LIDAR, canopy height and the gap fraction. And that was another issue with this very detailed mapping was the gap fraction. The fellow that, Gord Fraser, that did the LIDAR work, cautioned us about using that LIDAR, that gap fraction data, any smaller than about, he said 20 meters. I cheated a bit and went to 5. Partly because if you think of the size of a tree canopy, you can quickly end up in kind of confusing scale issues when one tree can affect the gap, the percentage of canopy in your predictions. So anyways, just a side point. And then we also had this rapid eye remote sensing imagery, which we added on to our points and along with our field data and ran it through these models. So this was the legend we developed. Basically, it's a parent material legend, shallow colluvium bedrock. Number one was our code. And these developed humods, udepts, and orthents on thin, coarse-textured soils. Morainal deposits were not that common, but they did have the spodic character in many cases, and also in the wetter areas we had these aquents and aquepts, or humoquepts, I guess. A very few fluvial deposits, and a big part of the landscape was covered by organic deposits, and there we split them again into well-drained and poorly drained, the folic histosols and the hemosols. And again, subdivided further by their depths. So this is what the upland thin soils looked like. There's a picture of one of the spodosols. These are the folic histosols, and then the hemosols here on the poorly drained sites. So what did we come up with in the model? Well, the map unit. I don't know if I can. I can't seem to get the. That's a typical output from the random forest model in the lower left. Many of you probably are familiar with this. If you're not, it just provides the parameters that we use to run the model, 500 classification trees, and in this case it was using 4 variables at each split. The error rate in this, hang on a minute, I jumped one there. This is the soil map units. 13% out-of-bag error, and when we did a cross-validation on this, it was about 16%. Typically, 3 to 5 to somewhat maybe more than that, our cross-validation errors were higher than the model-reported errors. And the map units the predictions were driven largely by remote sensing data, which is kind of interesting, as opposed to, and veg data, as opposed to topography. But the topographic variables come in lower, and they're still fairly significant. You can see the how far the dots are off the left axis in that picture. This is the ecosystem model, not quite as good, but again the veg indexes were fairly significant. The organic soil thickness was more driven by topography. With this, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but this valley bottom flatness index was one of the key drivers. It's a measure of sort of catchment area and how low you are in the terrain in a particular pixel and how flat the area is. And it has been shown to be a good correlator with soil depth. This is an index that was derived from some people in Australia. Now, this one for organic, these are the regressions now. And what you see here is the percent of variance explained is actually fairly low here, about 30%. So, and the squared residuals, that gives us a plus or minus 30 centimeter difference in our organic depth. So, not particularly exciting, but when you consider the variability in this landscape, I don't know. Anyway, it's what we got. Mineral soil thickness, I know there's a little bit of a challenge here, of course. You can imagine mineral soil thickness when you stop digging, that's your depth, right? It's very hard to predict below that. So there is this wrinkle with predicting soil mineral thickness. So in our case, we have to kind of consider these as minimum thicknesses because when we stop digging, it's not exactly sure how far we would have gone. There are ways perhaps that a person could get around that, but we didn't. In this project, we just simply used it as a minimum thickness. And the total thickness actually came out better. The percent variance explained down on the left there was about 45%, 46%. And now this is where these bedrock points got interesting. If we take the bedrock point out, and for our total soil thickness, the percentage of our variance explained, variation explained, drops way down to 32%. So they did have it helped the model significantly to anchor those points at bedrock where the depth, of course, is zero, right? And I think we've seen this before, and I've read it in other papers too, that in predictions of depth, it does help to show the model what it looks like where the depth is very low or zero. And these are the maps then. Well, the colors look quite different there than they do here, but well, that's almost a blue color for the... that bright blue color, anyway, are the deep folic histosols. Those are the sort of organic material directly over bedrock. And this is our soil map unit prediction. It's showing up pink on my screen. So, and the greener colors, which kind of get lost in the image there, are the deeper wetland organic soils. One of the things that sort of a key message here, I think, is if we go to this next slide, and I might switch back to it a couple of times, but you can see that large area of blue kind of in the middle to the left, how this is with bedrock points included, and this is without bedrock points included. So it kind of begs this question of the map error sort of mathematically defined versus what we actually see on the map. And we talked about, one of the previous speakers talked about this earlier. And this is where the expertise of Ian, our ecologist, has been so helpful. We're just in the early stages of it, but his backing and forthing, we will come to which of these maps is actually the better. It's not always possible to rely strictly on the quantitative data. These are just the maps for thickness of organic mineral materials. And in this case, this one, we also show without bedrock, and it had much less effect on the regressions. These are the results that came to the watershed, just showing that the rock, colluvium, morainal, fluvial, and organic are across the top of these axes, and showing that the watersheds had differences, but also the three methods of field training had differences. The field plots, the addition of the ecosystem plots, and the bedrock plots. And here we just show it again for all the watersheds. I was just showing the northern three in the other images, where the watersheds did show differences, and these were of interest to the hydrologists and did show up in their models as being somewhat drivers, not particularly sure why at this point or what, but they did seem to reflect the flows of materials out of the watersheds, but also our three training systems had effects on the model. Basically, I think I've covered all of this, the topographic derivatives. The random forest did do a pretty nice job, although it has its warts. And then finally, I think it is really helpful to have somebody on the ground that knows these ecosystems. And so the models, I think Jim said it really well, that they become tools, right? It doesn't replace the pedological expertise. So that's just a quick overview of a fairly simple project, but maybe a typical one that many of us will be involved in as these techniques become more used. Yeah, good point. Ian and I had a great debate on this. I was come into it cold and laid out those randomly designed points, and he said, why aren't we doing this by ecosystem? And, of course, partly because I wouldn't be able to identify those ecosystems, although there were people there that could have, perhaps. I didn't know that they could. Now I realize they would have been very good at that. And I just said, this is going to work. You just have to have faith, right? And in the end, I think it did provide us a lot. So you're right. I think stratification would be the right way to go, as long as you could be sure that your stratification was actually getting what you were hoping to get out of it. And in this case, I wasn't sure of that from my own perspective, and that's why we wouldn't do it. Maybe as you went on, that would probably be a good thing to do.
Well, your study could inform the next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.